This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Arne Duncan is on the broadcast today, the Secretary of Education on for-profit colleges, student debt, and whether everybody ought to go to college. Anyway, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 30th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Not a great day, however, to be the proprietor of a for-profit institution of higher education. Today, the federal government laid down some new rules for for-profit colleges. They fall under the rubric of what is known as the Gainful Employment Rule. In a nutshell, here you go. If a school graduate's loan payments add up to 20% of his or her discretionary income or 8% of their total paycheck, that school could lose its access to federal financial aid. And that would be big because a lot of for-profit schools get a whole lot of their income from federal financial aid, which is to say, from us. Arne Duncan is the Secretary of Education. Mr. Secretary, good to have you with us, sir.
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
This is your second go-around on these regulations. You're tightening them down a little bit. Why'd you feel the need to do that now?
We just simply think it's the right thing to do. We want to protect students from being burdened by too much debt. We want to protect taxpayers who are making a massive investment in these programs each year. And we want to see strong programs grow and expand and serve more students and more communities. And we want to see programs that aren't doing a good job either improve or cease to exist.
When you say cease to exist, would you reach in and shut down some of these programs that aren't doing what you want them to do?
We absolutely will have that ability if they don't improve over time. And the goal is not to play gotcha. The goal is to put in place some minimum thresholds. And the majority of programs we think are doing a decent job. But when people who are working hard end up in a worse financial position when they started, with debt that's unmanageable, with training that doesn't lead to real jobs, that for me is basically immoral, quite frankly.
So here's the broader philosophical question then. What do you do about the debt loads, not for kids in career schools that are targeted by these regulations, but in the broader higher education system in this country? Because, the kids at UCLA, I'm here to tell you, some of those aren't going to meet these debt load requirements, and yet UCLA is not subject to these rules.
Yeah. I travel the country. As I go to the grocery stores, I go to the dry cleaners. I hear about it everywhere I go. And this is not just in disadvantaged communities. This is, hardworking American families. So there isn't a simple answer. There are a couple pieces of this. First, we want to continue to invest in making higher education more affordable. And as you probably know, we put an additional $40 billion into Pell Grants in the first term without going back to taxpayers for a nickel. So we want to continue to invest ourselves. Secondly, we have to challenge states to reinvest in higher education. And during the tough economy, many states walked away from that. The final piece is we want to provide much better information to young people and their families. What's a grant? What's a loan? Not what the one-year cost is, what the four-year cost is. What are graduation rates? What do those look like? Finally, the president has challenged us in the not-too-distant future to come up with a rating system when we're looking at questions of like access and affordability for higher education.
I want to get to the ratings thing in a minute, but let me ask you about universities and their role in this. You, and I don't want to insinuate in any way that government has to do something about the high cost of education, right? That's not what this question is. This question is this. You are a guy who can call the president of Harvard University, your alma mater, and you can say, Drew, Dr. Faust, I don't know how you address her, are you kidding?
Madam President.
Madam President, fair enough. The question is, are you kidding me? $58,607 for tuition for the 2014-15 school year? Come on.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because you take an example like Harvard, where the sticker price, the tuition, is high, but they actually have an extraordinarily generous scholarship program, and low-income students can basically go to Harvard for free.
Which I totally get. I picked on Harvard because, A, I had Dr. Faust on the program 6 weeks ago, and I asked her that question, and she said, you know, we give lots of grants. But we also talked about Harvard's role and her role and the tippy-top layer of higher education in this country as role models and leaders for the rest of the system.
I spoke at the commencement of Arizona State last spring, and Arizona State is containing costs. They're attracting more low-income and minority students. Their graduation rates are going up, and they are graduating with skills to get great jobs. But yes, we need to build upon that success and replicate those best practices.
Let me ask you finally, Mr. Secretary, about the rating system that the White House has proposed that has
We haven't proposed it yet.
That is true. You have it has been talked about, shall we say?
Yes.
And you guys have gotten clobbered for it, and there's been some backing and forthing on this one. Do we really want higher education in this country? And I appreciate the need for transparency and disclosure and knowing what you're going to get for your money. But do we really want higher education in this country rated, as one of your deputy secretaries said not too long ago, like a blender?
Well, I don't know whether that's the right analogy or not, but let me just say this, that we as taxpayers, you and me and all your listeners, we invest $150 billion in grants and loans each year to make college accessible. And to think that we can make, as a nation, an investment of $150 billion each year and not have any sense of transparency or accountability, for me, that's not fair either to hardworking taxpayers or to young people and their families trying to make smart decisions.
I know I said that was the last question. I lied. Here's the real last question. Should everybody in this country go to college?
I think every young person in this country has to have some form of education beyond high school. So I always say whether it's four-year universities, two-year community colleges, trade, technical, vocational training, if young people drop out of high school today, they're basically condemned to poverty and social failure. There are no good jobs out there, as you know so well. The economy has changed. Yeah. And we want to lead the world in college graduation rates. Once again, we want to attract and retain high-wage, high-skilled jobs. And the only way to do that is to have the best educated workforce on the planet.
Arne Duncan is the Secretary of Education. Mr. Secretary, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Hey, thanks so much. Have a great day.
On Wall Street today, some pretty basic math. No higher ed needed. 2 + 2 equals the happy music. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Apple CEO Tim Cook wrote kind of an amazing essay in Bloomberg Businessweek today. "I'm proud to be gay," he wrote, "and I consider being gay one of the greatest gifts God has given me." That line makes Cook the first sitting Fortune 500 CEO to be out publicly, never mind that he runs arguably, not even arguably really, the most influential technology company on the planet. He went on, he did, Cook says, and this is a quote, "Part of social progress is understanding that a person is not defined only by one's sexuality, race, or gender," end of quote. And you can see that progress all around us, right? Just not so much in most of the executive suites of those other 499 companies in the Fortune 500. Stan Alcorn reports.
Tim Cook is a white man, like more than 90% of Fortune 500 CEOs, and less than 35% of all Americans.
It doesn't reflect at all the population.
Vanessa Cardenas at the Center for American Progress says by 2050, the majority of Americans will be people of color. The majority of the workforce will be women. So why don't we see that kind of diversity among our corporate leadership?
We'd all like to know that answer.
Donna Dabney looks at female underrepresentation at an organization called the Conference Board. She thinks we need to focus on what happens at the middle management level.
Men tend to get sponsored and women get mentored.
Good advice isn't as helpful as a hand up. Another problem is just getting on the ladder in the first place. Alexandria Walton Radford at RTI says the absence of Black and Latino executives goes back to college.
It's that these students are underrepresented at these elite schools, which is where these Fortune 500 companies go to recruit and hire.
Elite schools send a signal, especially to people who themselves went to elite schools. Dr. Shirley Davis, president of SDS Global Enterprises, says increasing diversity means stepping outside your comfort zone.
what really plays into this whole equation and why I think we have such a huge gap is because of unconscious bias.
Not so much conscious racism as people are used to picking people like them.
The typical profile of a corporate executive, CEO, or board of director is a white male, you know, in his late 40s or 50s, that's straight.
On that last score, at least, Tim Cook just shifted the needle. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
As long as we're talking about Apple, how about a little smartphone story, huh? Everybody knows the iPhone and Samsung's Galaxies. Anybody out there know who's the number three smartphone maker? Luckily for us, the sales numbers from this past summer are in, and Kate Davidson has them.
If you want to introduce Americans to the world's new third biggest smartphone maker, you got to master its name.
I like to pronounce it Xiaomi.
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 That last voice is Linda Sui with Strategy Analytics. She says Xiaomi edged past players like LG to take the smartphone bronze.
So far, Samsung still remains number one. Number two is Apple, but now Xiaomi is number three.
Analysts say this growth is incredible, given that Xiaomi sold its first phone 3 years ago. The Chinese company has passed Samsung and Apple in China and sold more than 17 million phones in Asia last quarter.
And again, because it's only within Asia, that's a huge number.
Ramon Lamas with IDC says these phones are
feature-packed, easy to use, rather inexpensive, and that really appeals to millions and millions of users. And here's the scary thing. It's just getting started.
Xiaomi is expanding in India with an eye on Brazil, Mexico, and Southeast Asia, but not the U.S. yet.
You cannot jump from the Chinese market straight to the U.S. market.
Boris Matadyev with 451 Research says customers in emerging markets prioritize cost and value, while customers in the U.S. are more loyal to brands like Apple. So Xiaomi has to keep growing.
Conquering step by step the developing markets, and once their name becomes more and more popular,
then he expects Xiaomi to test the U.S. market. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
We have talked in the past month or so about how now, all of a sudden, lots of companies, big pharma to small, are all interested in developing an Ebola vaccine. It's an expensive thing building a brand new medication, which is why most of the funding for the most promising treatments won't come from those private companies. It's going to come from a little agency buried deep inside the Department of Health and Human Services, which has launched something of a Manhattan Project for an Ebola cure. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
First, John Eldridge and his team at Perfectus Bioscience tested their Ebola vaccine on guinea pigs, then monkeys. At that point, Eldridge realized monkeys weren't getting sick.
When I saw those results, I realized that we had a real vaccine candidate which had the potential to make a real difference for mankind.
But to know for sure, the vaccine must be tested on humans, a timely and expensive proposition for tiny startups like Perfectus. And this is where things get tricky. Despite this year's outbreak, there's virtually no commercial market for Eldridge's vaccine. That's why the little agency no one's ever heard of, the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, is so important.
They're investing in things that would die if they didn't have additional funding.
Boston University's Kevin Outerson says getting any product from the lab to the market is called crossing the valley of death. He says for products like Eldridge's, which has little financial appeal, that valley is deeper and longer.
You can think of BARDA almost like a venture capital firm buried in the U.S. government.
To find an Ebola treatment, BARDA is investing in the most promising drugs and vaccines. That money, about $30 million for vaccines so far, changes the equation, so it makes better business sense for companies big and small to bring drugs to market. Unlike venture capitalists, BARDA won't take a cut, though. In fact, more money may be on the way, with the president expected to seek additional funding from Congress.
When we decided to put our pedal to the metal, everybody could accelerate and help us get to a finish line that we're aiming for.
Dr. Nicole Lurie is the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at HHS. She oversees BARDA.
Usually the development of vaccine, it can take 5, 6, 8, 10 years. We are moving forward at unprecedented speed.
With this crisis, Lurie says Washington and industry are hand in glove. Lurie's hoping to avoid mistakes from the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, when nearly 61 million Americans got sick and the virus killed more than 12,000, all while the government working with drug makers couldn't get enough flu vaccine manufactured.
So we learned that we need much stronger relationships with our industry partners.
Lurie sees signs of a massive Ebola manufacturing mobilization, from giants like GlaxoSmithKline to the little guys like Perfectus with John Eldridge, who says he's actually been given enough money to do the work.
We negotiated the contract. They came to us multiple times and said, we need to supply you with adequate funding that you can move as rapidly as possible.
Eldridge doesn't know if his vaccine works, but thanks to the tiny office no one's ever heard of, there's a chance. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we get our report card every single morning of how the customer felt about us the day before.
Retail at the very high end. The CEO of Neiman Marcus straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 221 points today, 1.3%, 17,195. The NASDAQ added 16 points. About a third percent, 45.66. The S&P 500, the broadest index, gained 12.6%, finished at 19.94. One company, Visa, accounted for a whole lot of the Dow's jump. Earnings topped estimates, and Visa said it's going to invest $5 billion in buying back its own shares. Those shares more expensive today, up 10%. The other credit card company, MasterCard, up 9% on higher profits. We were talking about rules for for-profit colleges. Apollo Education Group, which owns the University of Phoenix, up 4% today. Corinthian College is down 3.5%. Bonds up, the yield on the 10-year T-note, off to 2.30%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for September. Which state was the 36th to be admitted to the Union? Its state flower is sagebrush. One of its nicknames is Battleborn, and the year was 1864. Nevada. And what are you going as for Halloween? The Census Bureau suggests some occupations you could pick from. Bailiffs, dentists, and agricultural managers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Politics in North Dakota has historically been decidedly low-key, low-budget, too. But you start pumping money out of the ground, and that changes in a big, bad hurry. With an oil boom in full swing, political spending in North Dakota is way up, $17 million so far this year, more than double the midterms 4 years ago. And just like you'd think, the oil and gas industry is a big spender. Emily Guerin reports.
In the basement of the Burley County Courthouse in Bismarck, County Auditor Kevin Glatt is getting poll volunteers pumped for Election Day.
Smile! Okay? If you're going to be crabby on Election Day, stay in bed.
Voting in North Dakota feels, well, friendly. It's the last state in the entire nation where you don't even have to register to vote. Precincts are small, and volunteers like Bonnie Fix often recognize a lot of the voters who come through.
It's kind of like a reunion, like a family picnic type thing.
But it feels a little different this time around.
North Dakota is indeed a warm, friendly, open state in terms of elections, but it's gotten ugly.
Jim Fugley is the former head of the Democratic Party in North Dakota. He says the cost and tone of politics have changed since the oil boom began in 2008. He points to political ads like this as evidence.
Ryan Taylor calls himself a tree hugger.
That ad is attacking the Democratic candidate for agriculture commissioner. It was paid for by a local political action committee that got its money from the National Republican State Leadership Committee. And some of its top donors are oil and gas companies like Devon Energy and ExxonMobil. Here's Jim Fugley again.
We have never had an industry this big, with this much money, have this much of an influence on an election.
Between PACs, trade groups, and corporations, the oil and gas industry has so far spent $1.3 million on the 2014 election in North Dakota, according to state data. That's a lot for this rural state of just over 700,000 people. There's the ag commissioner race, because that person is one of three who regulate oil and gas. But the industry money has gone to every single Republican running for statewide office and to defeat a ballot measure, Measure 5.
We all want to keep North Dakota's outdoors great, but Measure 5 is a bad idea.
Measure 5 would set aside 5% of the oil extraction tax for conservation projects. It doesn't raise taxes, but the oil and gas industry is against it. Ron Ness is president of the North Dakota Petroleum Council, and he says that's because oil companies want to see as much money as possible go directly to the boom towns, fixing roads and building schools and housing.
The more oil tax money going back to those communities helps to attract and retain workforce.
Most of the industry spending has come from the American Petroleum Institute. It's bought yard signs, a website, and it's sponsoring a phone bank. Carmen Miller is the director of public policy for Ducks Unlimited, a conservation group backing Measure 5. She said they even called her office.
And if you're calling the proponents of the measure, you must be calling just about every phone number in the state.
All that money means everyone else has to up their spending. Conservation groups backing Measure 5, like the Nature Conservancy and Ducks Unlimited, have combined spent four times more than American Petroleum Institute.
We have more money to fight over, and we have more money to fight with.
Robert Harms is chairman of the Republican Party in North Dakota. The state takes in over $9 million a day in oil tax revenue, and Harms says everyone wants a say in how that money is spent. The oil boom has already transformed North Dakota's landscape and economy. Now it's doing the same with its politics. In North Dakota, I'm Emily Guerin for Marketplace.
Emily's story comes to us from the public media collaboration Inside Energy. New Yorkers, have we got retail news for you. Neiman Marcus, the company behind the luxury department store of the same name, which also owns Bergdorf Goodman, by the way, announced not too long ago it's going to be starting up a store in Manhattan. It'll be Neiman's first branch in the Big Apple in the 100 years since the company has been in existence. Doors, hang on to yourselves here, won't open until 2018, but it does get us to today's conversation from the corner office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Karen Katz is the CEO of the Neiman Marcus Group, which is based in Dallas, Texas. Karen, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I imagine this is a good time to be in the retail business as we approach the holidays.
Well, it's always interesting in the retail business. I will say that.
Interesting in a good way or interesting not in a good way?
No, it's actually interesting in a very good way. It's challenging and opportunistic times that we're living through in the retailing industry right now.
So that's a promising thing.
Some would call it promising.
You however,
we're always a little bit paranoid. So as retailers, we stay a little bit paranoid about what tomorrow is going to bring.
That's a little terrifying. How do you get up in the morning?
Well, I mean, that's kind of somewhat the thrill of the business. We actually get it's a different business than many because we get our report card every single morning of how the customer felt about us the day before. So, you know, I get a little flash sales is what we call them. I get it at 4 a.m. in the morning. And so on big days, I wake up earlier than I normally do just to see how the flash was from the day before. And I'm in a good mood if the business was great. And, you know, I have to decide what kind of mood I'm in if business wasn't so great.
Mm. Retail on the high end has been strong, really, even through the recession, right?
No, I'd probably have to disagree with part of that statement.
We had a
very, very difficult time during the recession. I think that as the stock market came crashing down and, you know, unemployment started soaring, I think our customer really viewed that as a time to pull back, and she pulled back dramatically. We have since rebounded quite nicely, but it took us a couple of years post-recession to kind of get our mojo back. I would say overall today, the business is very good.
You guys have an app now that does all kinds of whiz-bang things. You've got, obviously, NeimanMarcus.com, so there's an online retail component of this. How much does the average Neiman Marcus customer actually use digital services, if you will, versus coming into the store and saying, I want this, this, and that?
Well, I mean, digital has transformed our company in so many ways. A little over 24% of our business is now done online, and that's, kind of a percentage more than any other department store in the world. And through just talking to our customers, over 70% of them say they go to our website first. So they log on to neimanmarcus.com to do research by category before they come into one of our stores.
Can't talk to the head of Neiman Marcus without talking about the Christmas catalog and the, you know, umpteen zillion dollar whatever it is that you guys offer every year. Do you have somebody whose job it is to, like, stock that Christmas catalog, and so everybody can just go, this is bananas, man. Who needs this?
Yeah, we do. You know, we're really lucky because our Christmas book dates back to the 1950s. Yeah. And, you know, making the Christmas book even more spectacular year after year is no easy feat. But Ginger Reeder, who is a member of our team and who's been with us for about 15 years, she has many jobs at the Neiman Marcus Group, but one of her jobs is to find these over-the-top gifts that we put into the Christmas book each year.
I personally want where is it here? I got it right in front of me. I want the 100th anniversary Neiman Marcus limited edition Maserati Ghibli SQ4 for $95,000. So if anybody out there is listening,
it is a very cool car. So hopefully you have somebody nice. Santa will be nice to you this year.
Karen Katz is the CEO of the Neiman Marcus Group. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes to us, interestingly enough, from Sports Illustrated. The San Francisco Giants won the World Series last night, as you know. Pitcher Madison Bumgarner won the MVP award, for which he got a 2015 Chevy Colorado truck. Sadly, 2015 Chevy Colorados were recalled a couple of weeks ago by General Motors for faulty airbags. The good news is the GM says it caught most of them before they left the assembly plant, so Bumgarner is going to be fine. I never did understand, though, why those guys get cars, right? They can sort of buy their own trucks, millionaires. All right, we're done. The Dow up 221 points today, 1.3%. The NASDAQ added 16 points, about 1/3%. The S&P 500 up 12.6%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.